Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The final case for oral argument this term is Daryl Johnson, appellant versus Liebert Construction, FLE. For the appellant, Mr. Johnson is Mr. Mitchell Peterson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, Liebert Construction is Mr. Kent Cutler, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Peterson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court. Counsel. Your Honors, I represent Daryl Johnson in this case. He had construction work performed under contract with Liebert Construction Incorporated, which is a concrete company in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The concrete was installed incorrectly. Specifically, saw cuts or control joints were put in excess of 15 feet apart, and in some cases, as much as 25 feet apart. Liebert Construction admits this error. Liebert Construction and its experts also admit that the improper placement of saw cuts has caused excessive cracking. There is a dispute as to exactly what percentage, but all parties and all witnesses agree that there was increased cracking, substantial increased cracking, because of the improper saw cuts. Liebert Construction also admits that the improper saw cuts would not be within the industry standard and would not be within a workmanlike quality of concrete pouring.
Well, you say they admitted it. You got to argue it to a jury, so why are we here?
We're here, Your Honor, because of the damage issue. Liebert Construction proposed only awarding damages to put sealant in the cracks. Their expert, Roger Back, has said he would guarantee it for 1 year, but it would only last for 2 years. Mr. Backus also agreed that this concrete has approximately 20 to 25 more years of life, meaning that 2 years down the road, Daryl Johnson is in exactly the same position that he's in without any award. There's absolutely no compensation for the last 18 to 23 years of the life of the concrete. He's saddled with additional maintenance expenses and additional problems with durability. Under Bad Wound and many other cases, The goal of contract damages is to remedy all damages proximately caused by the breach and to place the non-breaching party in the position he would occupy had the breaching party performed their duties fully. In this case, just awarding sealant damages, and actually the jury only awarded half of that, Daryl Johnson is not in the same position he would be in if Liebert had performed the contract 2 years down the road, even if we agree that sealant's an appropriate remedy. What they needed, maybe sealant with a plan over the 20 to 25 years may be an appropriate remedy if the jury doesn't feel that replacing the concrete is appropriate. But there's not even enough money to seal it once in this case. For that reason, the damages are inadequate. This case, this court previously, when it has addressed...
Just a minute, let me interrupt you, because when you say there wasn't enough to even seal it once, a lot of the cracking, the testimony was a lot of the cracking would have occurred even if the saw joints had been properly placed. And I understand there's a dispute about what percentage. So the roughly $13,000 bid, but as I understand it, related to all the joints, even the ones that would have been there, that would have had to been sealed, if the saw joints had been properly placed, isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the fact that you did get enough to take care of the joints that were caused by the defect, at least to seal them.
Well, according to Roger Backus, half of the cracks would be there no matter what you did, and half of there because of the error.
And the bid was for all the cracks.
That is correct, Your Honor. So under the light most favorable to the party in whose verdict we're appealing, which is the standard applied by this case, by this court, There's enough money to fix the cracks that are there because of the error once for 2 years. So there's still no money to fix just even half the cracks that Roger Backus says are related to the error from the last 18 to 23 years of the life of the concrete. There's absolutely no compensation for that. And under the law, Daryl Johnson is entitled to compensation for that. This court has previously looked at damage issues specifically in deciding whether to overturn a verdict or to grant a new trial. The Gold versus Mann's case, when the jury awarded just medical bills and no compensation for general damages, pain and suffering, and other things the plaintiffs are entitled to, the court said that was an erroneous verdict and should be overturned and a new trial should be granted. In this case, it's no different. I mean, Daryl Johnson's received, even assuming only half the cracks are there because of the error, he's essentially received his medical bills for 2 years when we know treatment's going to last 20 to 25 years. That's not fair compensation under the law. And this court should reverse the denial of our motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict and alternatively could grant a new trial.
Was it in dispute that it would not last longer than 2 years or that it needed to be repaired going forward? Longer than what the bid was for?
That was not in dispute. The testimony about the sealant only lasting 2 years, but the concrete lasting 20 to 25 years, was from Roger Backus, Liebert Construction's expert. Nobody ever disputed that. The remedy that Daryl Johnson provided the jury, and the numbers were not disputed as to what would cost to do it, was to replace certain concrete slabs and then to do a sealant with an epoxy top coat. And I don't know if your honors have been in a lot of garages recently have that fancy speckled top coat. That's not what we're talking about. It's just a clear, basically prophylactic layer to keep the elements from degrading the sealant over time, to keep it in place, keep it from pushing up from natural forces. That's the kind of epoxy sealer that we're discussing in this case.
Well, if the cement's going to last 25 years, are we talking about cosmetics rather than function?
Well, aesthetics are one issue, but in this case, the real core issue is maintenance costs over the life of the concrete. Daryl Johnson never bargained for an additional $6,500 every 2 years to do sealant. That's not what he signed up for, and that's exactly what Liebert Construction's breach has caused. And the jury has absolutely ignored the last 23 years of the life of the concrete. For that reason,
I'm assuming this was argued to the jury at trial, did you argue a whole different theory for damages to the jury?
Well, Your Honor, it's twofold. Number one, we argued for replacement of the concrete. Alternatively, in the trial record in the closing arguments, we argued to the jury that even if you accept that, you know, maybe we shouldn't rip up this concrete, maybe we should do something a little less drastic and do sealant, damages need to be awarded for the life of the concrete to take into account all of the maintenance expenses, not just the next 2 years, but for the life of the concrete. And it's the lifespan that Liebert Construction expert and their witnesses said it would last that long, and they said that the repair they're offering would last 2 years. I mean, that's not in dispute. So, I mean, the ultimate question for this court is, as a matter of law, is somebody entitled to full compensation for all damages caused by the breach? Even if there's a difference or a difference of opinion about whether you should replace or repair, we still need at least all of the money to do the repairs for the natural life of the concrete. On the other hand...
So would we remand it, or do you get a new trial, or what are you asking for?
Well, number one, Your Honor, we're asking under Rule 50B that we receive judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which this court could reverse the trial court's decision denying that with instructions to enter judgment in the amount of the replacement cost provided by us, because it's the only reasonable measure of damages presented by the jury. Alternatively, if the court is not inclined to do that but sees that the verdict is improper, we would request a new trial.
On the first point, there was evidence from the opposing expert, as I recall, that replacement was unreasonable and unnecessary. So the jury heard, if I recall correctly, the jury heard evidence that your proposal was unreasonable and unnecessary. And if that's the case, then we've got to leave that for the jury, don't we?
Well, that argument was presented that it was unreasonable when compared to repairing it. But the other side of the coin wasn't put there to repair it for the life of the concrete. The jury was only presented with one damage remedy that would actually put Gerald Johnson in the same position he should be in if there was no breach for the life of that concrete. Now, no one disagreed that the actual costs were unreasonable. Nobody disagreed that because of labor costs, concrete costs, increased fuel costs, that it actually cost $60,000 to rip up the concrete and repour it, and that it cost $39,000 or $40,000 to seal an epoxy top coat the interior. There's no dispute that that's what the actual costs were. The only argument made by Liebert is Darrell Johnson should receive essentially a Band-Aid for his injury in this case, a two-year fix, and that's it. And that's what the jury went with. And
Did Judge Teedy address that in his opinion that he wrote here in his decision? This particular argument that the $6,500 wasn't only covered 2 years as opposed to the next, whatever, 20?
It is addressed in there. There's probably not a lot of analysis there that really delves into that. It's more of an issue of the jury decided it, so that's well with respect, because there certainly is a deference to jury verdicts. We're not contending otherwise, but there are limits on what juries can do, especially when the damages awarded don't compensate Darrell Johnson anywhere near to the level that he should be. The other issue in this case, and certainly it's a threshold issue, is the timing of the filing of the appeal. The court asked for additional briefing on that, and it's a fairly narrow issue in this case. The notice of entry of judgment was filed August 11th. Darrell Johnson's post-trial motions were filed the same day. A week later, on August 18th, Judge Teedy issued a memorandum opinion in the form of a letter indicating that...
Was there a hearing, or did he just rule based on the motions?
I believe arguments took place in the directed verdict phase. Mr. Cutler can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know that we specifically had a hearing on the post-trial motion. The letter decision indicated Judge Teedy's decision, directed Mr. Cutler to serve a proposed order. Mr. Cutler did send an order to our office via email. It wasn't formally served under the service rules and our rules of civil procedure. And then, unbeknownst to the parties, Judge Teedy entered that proposed order, and it was filed on August 23rd, 2006, with no service of the order and no actual notice to either party. This isn't a case where we're claiming Liebert Construction was hiding the ball. Nobody knew that Judge Teedy had entered the order.
But the statute seems, I realize it's kind of a nasty statute, but it says that the time starts to run from attestation and filing of the order. It doesn't really give you much other room. Once it's filed, whether you know about it or not, your time starts to run.
That's true, Your Honor, and I would have a couple of responses to that. The first would be that that only addresses whether the underlying judgment itself has been timely appealed. It doesn't answer the question of whether the order denying post-trial relief has been timely filed. And in the case law cited by us, there are distinct appeal time frames for both of those, one for the judgment and a separate appeal time for the order. Number two, under the terms of judgment.
Let me see if I understand what you're saying, because I'm looking at the statute again. It says, let me just read this. It says, the full time for appeal fixed by this section commences to run and is to be computed from the attestation and filing of the order made pursuant to such motion. So it looks like to me if you had 60 days from the filing and from the notice of the judgment, then you file your motion, so the 60 days stops And the 60 days would then begin, according to this statute, if we just look at this statute alone, as of August 23rd, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't misunderstanding
it. And just procedurally, when the court looks at it, at the time post-trial motions are filed, the only appeal time frame that's running as of that time is the judgment itself. There's nothing else to be appealed. The statute says that time frame is suspended when a post-trial motion is filed, and you know, for the time it takes to make that decision or get an order on the post-trial motions. At that point, then the only appeal time frame that's resumed, because it's the only one that existed prior to the post-trial motions, would be the appeal time frame as to the judgment. That then picks up and runs for the stated time in the statute. That answers the question only as to the judgment. But as to the order denying the post-trial motions, that runs from notice of entry of the order denying the post-trial relief. That's an entirely separate issue.
Is there a case authority on that?
There's nearly a century of authority cited in our brief.
I know a lot of the cases you cite are pretty old, centuries old. They are century old, but is there cases cited after we enacted the code?
Well, there are a number of cases. It's not exactly the same issue, but the recent case of Glover versus Krambeck, the party specifically has a right to appeal a Rule 60B motion that's denied. The courts also looked in Midcom that an injunction and a separate post-trial award of attorney's fees are separately appealable to this court.
But do you have a case that says that a Rule 59 order is separately appealable?
There is, but not since the most recent version of Rule 59 and Rule 50 have been enacted. The only thing that's really changed is the timing deadlines, but the concept in terms of orders being separately appealable, that's been the law since the beginning of the case law that we've cited. There's nothing that's ever changed that.
Do you have a case that's where we have actually heard an appeal solely on the question of a Rule 59 decision?
Well, in the Dean versus Seaman case that we cited in our brief, there the appeal as to the judgment was not timely filed, but an appeal as to the order denying post-trial relief was timely filed. In that case, the court held, and I quote, so far as the judgment is concerned, the appeal is too late under the present statute and will be disregarded. But the motion for the new trial had been submitted to the court before the right to appeal from the judgment had expired.
But this is a 1920 case. This is long before we enacted the federal rules.
It is long before that, Your Honor, but there is absolutely nothing in the new rules, either of appellate procedure or civil procedure, that extinguishes the independent right to appeal an order denying post-trial relief. The case law has been consistent for nearly a century that any judgment or any order affecting a substantial right can be appealed. In this case, certainly an order denying a motion for new trial and a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict affects substantial rights of Darryl Johnson. Those appeals are separate and apart from appealing the underlying judgment. Additionally, if the court concludes that those two motions have been properly appealed under the McLean case, the court in McLean said that as long as the post-trial motion denial, as long as that's timely appealed, the court can review all of the underlying matters in the case. If the court were inclined to extend that precedent to this case, then everything could be reviewed. And even if it's not, the central issue in this case is the judgment notwithstanding the verdict in the motion for new trial.
I want to follow up something, though. You say that, so your appeal time on the denial of the motion you're contending solely on the Rule 59 denial would commence at the time, not at the time that the order was attested and filed, but at the time you received notice of entry.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And how would that affect the other side of that rule that says that when that kind of a motion is denied, after the expiration of 20 days, then the judge hasn't acted, it's automatic. How does that work then? Because there wouldn't be any notice with that kind of, there'd be no order.
It would at that point be incumbent upon the party wants to guard against an appeal, to follow it up with an order to the judge, or even to file some sort of notice, the notice of expiration of 20 days, there could be some steps that are taken in order to get that clock to start running.
So this, I mean, this adds a whole, I realize this is kind of maybe a new issue, but this adds a whole new bunch of material rules onto rule this rule here that says it just automatically expires. So it, now you're saying there has to be a notice, there has to be a formal notice after the 20 days expire, or the simple expiration of the 20 days would not terminate your right to appeal. It would, you would continue on and on until someone told you that the 20 days had expired.
Well, Your Honor, under the deemed denied language, I think it would be incumbent upon the party to obtain an order from the judge specifically denying that, or at least provide some sort of notice. I would think this court could acknowledge that if a party provides formal notice that 20 days have expired, that could be the triggering mechanism in order to start that appeal, so that there is a finite end to the appeal process.
I don't know the answer to this question, so I'm curious if you know. What is the federal equivalent? Do the federal rules now, as they exist now, have this automatic denial after 20 days, or is that unique to South Dakota?
I'm not aware of what that particular requirement is. My time has expired.
I have one question. It's your position that after the 20 days and it's deemed denied, even though it's on an order that you requested it, you expect the other side to give you notice that the 20 days is up?
Well, in any case, the other side would be giving notice of the judgment as well. It's the party who wants to cut off the appeal time frame needs to take steps to do that and provide notice of an order, a judgment, or the lapse of 20 days.
But if you file a request for a new trial or post-trial motions, and you know that it expires in 20 days unless you get the judge to extend it, do you expect the other side to give you notice? I thought that was your position, and I think the answer is yes, but you haven't said so yet. But you expect the other side to give you notice that the 20 days is now passed and it's deemed denied?
Yes, if the other side wants to cut off the appeal time frame, I think that's the step that should be taken by the party who wants that protection.
Otherwise, it would run on indefinitely? One year, 2 years, 3 years?
It could, just like with a judgment. If they never file notice of entry of the judgment, the clock doesn't start to run.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cutler, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Morning. May it please the court, counsel. If I may, I'd like to start by addressing this timeliness issue also, as it is a procedural hurdle, obviously, to the court considering the substantive issues in this case. But SDCL 1526A6 is very clear in its requirements. You have to have an order that's attested and filed within 20 days, or the post-trial motions are deemed denied. And the appeal time would begin to run on the attestation and filing of the order, or on the 21st day of the filing of your motions if the court took no action. It's clear, concise, the legislature has spoken. The rules of statutory construction require the court to follow this clear, plain language. And it's important to note that this language that we're talking about in regard to the post-trial motions differs from the language.
This is actually a Supreme Court rule.
A Supreme Court rule, yes, Your
Honor. Yeah, we have spoken.
You have spoken, yes. I apologize.
Maybe not too clearly.
Well, but I think you have, Your Honor, because the court has used a differing language with respect to the judgment and with respect to the post-trial motions. The judgment does require that there is a notice provided to the other party at which time the appeal time begins to run. With respect to the post-trial motion decision or lack of decision, you only need an attestation and a filing. And the reason for that, it only makes sense. If the court takes no action, the appeal time needs to start to run at some point. There's nothing to give notice of if the judge or the circuit court takes no action. It makes no sense that if the court takes action that you'd have to give a notice of entry because things could drag on indefinitely. And I believe the purpose of this rule is to ensure that appeals are handled in a timely and an efficient manner. We have a judgment. We have a notice of entry. Let's have a decision within 20 days if they file their motions within 10 days. It's a 30-day window for this whole deal. You have a notice of entry, a judgment. You have 10 days to make your post-trial motions, and the circuit court then has 20 days to do something or do nothing.
But, you know, did you do the computing? I mean, if the judge here had done nothing,
right,
then wouldn't the appeal have been timely? I mean, if you take the 20 days on the day...
You know, I was in my hotel room last night reading the reply brief, and I was trying to understand all the arguments that were being made, and sometimes I'm a little slow. I didn't calculate it out, but I know Mr. Peterson said, you know, if I filed it on I think the 20 days he thought would run September 3rd, and had it been September 3rd and you did the 60 days, he believed that he was within that time frame. I didn't compute it out. It sounds like maybe that would be the case.
Hypothetical question.
I don't think that's the date, though, Your Honor. I think the date is the date of the attestation and filing, which is August 23rd.
Says, but, you know, let me ask you this. I mean, how can a person be held to have notice of something they don't know exists? Isn't this a due process violation?
Well, I don't think so. Now, these motions, we have to keep in mind, were for the benefit of Darryl Johnson. He made these motions to the court seeking this relief that he did not receive from the jury. And there was some notice because Judge Teedy sent both Mr. Peterson and myself, I believe by email. That's how we communicate a lot. And Judge Teedy does a lot of emails. I believe he sent us his written opinion by email. Mr. Peterson received that. My office was asked to prepare a proposed order, which Kim Wasink of my office did. She emailed that back to Judge Teedy, emailed it to Mr. Peterson, and what happened was, and this is maybe the one problem with email a little bit, is that we used to send a letter with the order and three copies and say, conform them and put them in our mailbox. Well, Judge Teedy printed it off his computer, signed it, and filed it. Now, Mr. Peterson wants it to be the burden of the non-moving party, Liebert, the party not seeking this relief. He wants us to be responsible for having to call the clerk's office. He knew that we had sent the proposed order. He knew that Judge Teedy had written opinion denying his motions. He has a telephone. He could call the clerk's office as well as we could, and he had the information at hand to know that there was a decision that was being made, or at a minimum, Justice Konenkamp, that if the order wasn't entered by whatever the date was, September 3rd, that it was deemed denied. And we know that because of the Snyder case, Snyder et al. Versus American Family Insurance, which is 480 Northwest 2nd 767. We've cited this in our brief. This case is the companion case to what we have here. And the only way that the Snyder case and this case can live in harmony is for this court to say, it runs from the attestation and filing of that order, if there is an order, or it runs from day 21 if the court takes no action. The Snyder case dealt with a situation where the court actually took some action, had a hearing, I believe on the 20th day, but didn't actually enter a written order stating what the decision was of the court until some period of time later. And the two insurance companies in that case then calculated their appeal time from the date that the court entered its order denying the motions, which was well after the 20 days. This court, and Justice Sabres, I believe, was the sole justice out of you all that was serving at the time, found, I believe, 4-1, that there is not a substantial compliance thing that goes along with this statute. This statute is a strict compliance statute. You have to meet the timelines to have a timely appeal, and it may have seemed harsh at that point in time, but American Family and Aetna had not filed their appeals timely, and this court would not hear the substantive issues because there was not subject matter jurisdiction. That's exactly what's happened in this case with the first half of that statute, where we actually have an order that is made within those 20 days.
Okay, let's say we're going to stick with that rule and adopt that position. But what about the cases that say, under analogous rules before our recent rule, that say that you still can appeal from the JNOV and the new trial? And it seems to me that even though we've adopted rules since those cases, the substantive provisions of those prior rules really aren't any different than what we're talking about today.
Justice Enter, I've read the rule that was in place at the time of those cases, which were, I think, 1917 and 1920, and the rule did not specifically address post-trial motions in that rule. The rule just said you had 1 year to appeal from a judgment or 60 days to appeal from an order. Okay? It didn't specifically address the post-trial motions like the Supreme Court rule does at this point in time. So I do think there's a substantial difference.
But the cases did. The rule may not have been specific.
Right. Well,
but the early cases clearly said that even if you blew it on the judgment, you could still appeal on the JNOV and new trial.
They did, but there wasn't this automatic denial language at that point in time. The court actually had to enter an order back in the 17s and the 20s, either denying or granting this relief, at which time there would be a notice of entry of order, and there would then be 60 days from that entry of that order for them to appeal, because it said an order you could appeal in 60 days and a judgment you could appeal within a year. The rules have changed substantially since that point in time, and all the rules that have been changed in the court just recently, we just changed the appeal time from 60 to 30 days. We have continually shortened the appeal time so that we can condense this process and it does not drag out forever. And I believe that statute is much different than what we're dealing with here. We have specific language now in the statute that addresses this subject, and I think if the court wants to be consistent with its decision in Snyder, that the decision, and I realize it's harsh, but it's what the statute provides. This appeal is not timely.
Do the federal courts allow for, if the time for appealing a judgment has expired, do the federal courts allow for appeal of a denial of a judgment, NOV, or for a new trial?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I can look for cases for you on that if you'd like me to. I apologize. I don't know the answer today.
You have done enough. I can do that.
Okay. Thank you. But, and quite frankly, this isn't in the record, but the way that I ended up doing a notice of entry in this case is I saw Mr. Peterson like on October 1st in Sioux Falls, not in any work-related environment, and I said, I'm glad that thing's done. I'm glad you didn't appeal it. And he said, well, you haven't noticed entry of that order yet. So I went to the office the next Monday or whenever it was after I saw him, and we called the clerk, we got the order, and I noticed the entry of it. I mean, he could have done the same thing. And I guess the point being this, if I wouldn't have had that conversation, I would have probably never done that, and we might still be sitting there with an appeal out there if you accept Mr. Peterson's argument that he has 60 days from the date that somebody does a notice of entry of order of this order denying those post-trial motions. So I'd like to address, if I can move on now, unless the court has other questions on that subject, to talk about the damages issue briefly. And this is a case where there were saw cuts that were not spaced properly on this concrete. But the testimony from all of the experts was that this concrete was suitable for its intended purpose, that it was structurally sound. Other than Mr. Bernhard, nobody really thought anything should be replaced, and both my experts were of the opinion. Greg Hannestad, who's a structural engineer, said maybe 25% more cracking than you would expect. Roger Bacchus said maybe 20% more cracking than you'd expect. And quite frankly, I told the jury in this case, too, to refer to these as cracks is a little unfair. Because they really, you know, people think of cracks as something you can maybe see down in. These are hairline fractures you could hardly even see when you walked on the concrete, and they were so difficult to see that Mr. Johnson had actually taken spray paint, you had the exhibits, and had taken bright orange spray paint to spray these cracks so you could see them in the photographs that he put before the jury. The jury went out and had an opportunity to inspect this site, and they reached a decision based on the testimony that was provided at trial. Interestingly enough, Mr. Bernhard, who provided this $102,000 bid to repair and remove this concrete, admitted that he wasn't asked to go out there and assess the situation and give his opinion as to what he would recommend be done. Mr. Johnson told him, here's what I want done. I want this removed. I want this removed. I want this removed. I want this replaced. I want to have this sealed, and I want an epoxy finish over. And he did the bid at Mr. Johnson's direction. Mr. Peterson's civil engineers don't generally deal with concrete, but his civil engineer even acknowledged that there really was no need to replace any of this concrete. He said, I might replace one of the squares out there because it maybe is not as pretty looking as it should because it has these hairline fractures. The fact of the matter is the jury heard, I think, significantly more evidence that there was no need to replace this, that sealing was the right remedy, than they heard that this needed to be replaced. There was obviously conflicting evidence. The jury is the finder of fact, and they found that replacing it was not reasonable. Mr. Johnson wanted perfect concrete. At least that's what he told the jury.
But let me interrupt you, because let's move away from the focus on what the jury rejected,
okay,
and look and see what the jury did do. And here, there's no dispute that at least 20% of these cracks are due to a defect. And it appears to me that I'm just going to use 13,000 as a round figure, is not going to take care of sealing those 20% cracks over the life of this concrete.
It very well could. Let me explain to you how. Okay. Roger Backus and Greg Hanson, my expert, said that 20 to 25% of these hairline cracks could have been avoided with appropriately spaced saw cuts. Judge Teedy, in his memorandum letter in denying this, said, you know, that could mean that the initial work in routing out and sealing could be as little as $2,500 related to the saw cuts not being properly spaced. After you do the initial routing out and sealing, the routing out is the big part of the job. You got to take a router and you got to actually widen the cracks before you put the sealant in them. After you do that initial routing out, then when you go back, it's simply a sealing exercise. You don't have all that work routing it out again. So the jury heard all this evidence, and I don't know how. We didn't have special interrogatories. I don't know how they came to 6,500, but it was within the realm of the high and low figure that I believe they could have awarded in this case. The other part of this is when we went out and did the jury view, Mr. Johnson parked a pickup in a trailer to try to avoid anybody looking at his other concrete. But Mr. Johnson was well aware that this is what you do for concrete, because he had concrete right next door that had sealant all over it. So this is a normal, you know, we refer to it, I guess, in this case as a repair, but this is really more of a maintenance item. And, you know, the jury was given instruction number.
Well, let me ask you this before I forget. I didn't see anything in the briefs about the jury being told that X amount of dollars would maintain these 20% cracks for the 20, 25 years. Are you saying that the jury was told that this thing, that the routing was the big expense up front, and then thereafter sealing would be cheaper and it wouldn't cost that much? Because I didn't read anything in the briefs about that.
Okay. I don't know that's in the briefs. I believe there was testimony to that effect. If I'm mistaken, I apologize. There was not, though, Your Honor. You're correct. There was not any number given to the jury as to what it would cost to provide maintenance for this 20% of the cracks for I'd say it's more 15 to 20 years because the concrete was 5 years old at the time we tried this case, too. It had a life expectancy of 20 to 25 years, and it was already 5 years old, too. So we're talking about a little shorter life, remaining lifespan than 20 to 25 years. The other part is we did have a mitigation claim in this case, and there was also testimony that Daryl Johnson served as the general contractor on this project, and the experts talked about what that meant, and that, you know, if he served as the general contractor, you know, he and directed this work, which he was out there each day when this work was going on, that, you know, he could bear some responsibility for this. In addition, he would not let my client come on and do additional saw cuts after the issue arose. I don't know how that played into the jury's decision, but there are a lot of factors that dovetail into this in making their decision. Obviously, what they talked about, nobody knows. But I had another point I wanted to make on this. But
I interrupted you. You were going to tell us about the jury instruction.
The jury instruction, right. Mr. Johnson, and I think one of the problems throughout this case was that Mr. Johnson wanted what I would refer to as perfect concrete. He wanted concrete that had no cracks in it, had a great finish, and it's going to last forever. And all of our experts acknowledge there's three things you know about concrete. One, it gets hard. Two, it turns white. And three, it cracks, and it just happens. The jury instruction number 23, and it comes off of our Bunkers-Jacobson case, which is actually cited in the briefs for the prejudgment interest proposition. But this was a jury instruction that was proposed by my office and I think was agreed to by Mr. Peterson. He certainly didn't object to it. But, you know, you don't get perfect. What you get when you get a warranty on this work is that the work would be performed in a reasonably good and workmanlike manner and that the completed product shall be reasonably fit for its intended purpose. Everybody testified that that was the case. The experts testified that the industry standard would be that you would go in and do some sealing of this concrete. You would not go rip out this concrete. It had rebar in it. It was not moving. There was no differential movement, which would show there was poor compaction. It was in good usable form. And this sets forth the law. It's not Mr. Johnson's expectation that I want perfect concrete with no cracks in it that sets the bar to determine what the damages are in this case. And I think the jury considered all the evidence that was presented, and there was some conflicting evidence, although I'd say for the most part, the evidence did not support this replacement of any of the concrete. The jury considered all this in making their determination.
Before you run out of time, and you're almost out, on prejudgment interest, it seems to me as a matter of law that the jury was required to give interest on the $6,500 from some date. As a matter of law, that's the change in 13.1 that was adopted many years ago.
The jury, as I understand it, the jury is to determine whether it's prejudgment interest, put the date and the amount of money in the blanks. The verdict form came back.
Actually, that's not really what we've said before. They're to determine the date if that's a question, but they're not supposed to put an amount in. We've very clearly said that in some prior cases that the judge does that now under the new statute.
Okay.
So it was done improperly in this case.
Okay.
I don't know, but nobody objected to it.
Yeah, well, I guess we agreed on the verdict form, so we were wrong, I guess. But a couple things. One, if Mr. Peterson thought that there was a problem with the verdict form, he should have requested Judge Teedy to have the jury go back and further deliberate on that issue. Two, all the bids that were presented to the jury were in present-day dollars. Three, Mr. Johnson had not spent any of his own money doing any repairs at that property, so it wasn't like he'd spent $5,000 5 years earlier. And there was not a lot of testimony by which the jury could determine it. And I think the jury probably decided, you know, this Bacchus bid of $13,000 is today's bid. It's not 5 years ago, and we're not going to award that. And I think that was a decision for the jury to make.
Thank you, Mr. Cutler.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Peterson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Your Honors, I'd like to touch on a few points raised by Mr. Cutler. The first is the issue of mitigation of damages. Mr. Cutler alleges that Lieber Construction offered to come out and do saw cuts. There is evidence to that. Nobody disputes that. What's left out is Liebert Construction told Daryl Johnson that he had to say where the saw cuts were going to go. He's the customer. He's not the expert in that case, and that's why he told them, I don't know where to put them. I can't tell you where to put them. And on top of that, Greg Hannestad, the structural engineer for Liebert Construction, said that Daryl Johnson's failure to do remedial measures early on after the concrete was cured has very little to do with the current condition of the concrete. There's no dispute about that. The only dispute on whether there's mitigation of damages is the argument of counsel, and that's not evidence. The evidence in this case is clear. There is no mitigation issue. On this issue of, you know, is the sealant, is it front-end heavy? Is there routing? Is there all this work to do? And it gets really cheap as you go on over time. Again, I don't think there's testimony or evidence to support that in the trial record. You can be sure that Mr. Cutler and his firm would have argued that point more forcefully in their brief, or at least set forth an argument on that issue. There isn't evidence to support that.
You're saying there is no evidence on that?
There is not evidence on that. Dividing up that, you know, this is front-end heavy and it's only a minimal cost as you go on. There was no life care plan or no life of the concrete analysis provided. It was a one-time only bid. I think Roger Backus even called that the bid one-time, comma, one-time only. That's it. That's the bid that he gave. $13,000, and he said half of that's unrelated to the breach, half is related to the breach. And that's what the jury came back with in this case and awarded no damage for the remainder of the life of the concrete. Those facts are not disputed. There's certainly a dispute about whether Daryl Johnson's entitled to rip up and replace the concrete, or is he entitled to the maintenance expenses over the life of the concrete. The jury didn't give him either. They gave him, even under the light most favorable to Liebert Construction and Roger Backus, they gave him enough money to seal the breach-related cracks one time, which will last 2 years.
It sounds to me like the jury was given an all-or-nothing proposition, and they weren't going to give yours, apparently because of the evidence, it was unreasonable. And what they were given on the other side wasn't acceptable, and they had to come to something in the middle.
Well, Your Honor, I would refer the court to my closing argument in that case, which is part of the court record. And I did argue to the jury that if they're inclined not to allow replacement, that they need to figure all of the repair costs, not just the one time.
But how could they do that if there was no evidence presented on the point?
The argument that was made, Your Honor, is Roger Backus's bid of $13,000 is the sealant bid. You know, whatever they think is related to that, that's 2 years, and there's 20 to 25 years, so award that for every 2 years. It's just a simple math exercise, which I did go through with the jury. So they were presented that based on the repair analysis provided by Roger Backus.
So you were arguing something in the neighborhood of $70,000 or something for the 25-year period of time, or what's remaining is 20 years?
I don't remember the specific number. I know I did calculate it out because there was I did delay slightly getting up to the rebuttal in the closing argument to make that point, and I had to do the calculation and didn't have a calculator. So it's something that was made. I don't have that trial notebook here to look at what that specific number is, but certainly the court could remand this case for a new trial, and we could get into all of that and hopefully arrive at a fair and justified verdict, which did not take place in this case.
I want to ask you a question on the timeliness of the appeal. If you interpret this statute that in a little different manner, in that you have 20 days that isn't, I think I've got this right now, the trial court has 20 days to decide one way or the other. And on the 21st day, if they don't decide, you assume it's denied.
That would be the deemed denied language.
The deemed denied. And then you would have 60 days from the 21st day. Were you within that time frame in your appeal?
Our argument there is that the motion was filed, I'm just looking at my date here, August 11th, 2000, 6. That was the notice of entry of judgment and the same day we filed our motions. They were served by mail. Under our rules of civil procedure, that adds 3 days to all response times under the rules. And then you add the 20-day deemed denied window. That brings it to September 3rd. 60 days from that is November 2nd. We filed our appeal on October 31.
Okay, so you were within the 60 days, even if we take it from that deemed denied business. Because
yes,
you would, although you maybe did have actual notice of it, let's assume you didn't. I mean, you would have deemed denied at 21 days if you didn't know any differently. If he'd have just signed it and filed it and you never knew anything about it, it would be deemed denied. So you were still within that time frame.
Yes, Your Honor, we were. And additionally,
assuming the three-day mailing rule to the rule, isn't it?
I believe so, Your Honor.
You have to have the 3-day mailing rule, and of course, the statute doesn't say. I mean, I'm not saying arguing that maybe it applies, but the statute says 20 days from the time of the motion, which would be August 31st. So I don't know. Maybe that.
But the problem here, to further confuse this, the trial court didn't wait 20 days. The trial court ruled in about 10 or 11 days. As I read it, the trial court ruled on August 23. Your motion was filed around August 11. So the trial court ruled way before the 20-day period.
Yes, it did.
So that's the problem we have in this case.
The trial court acted too quickly.
Yes.
Yes, and that's the bottom line. The case law has never changed in terms of a party's right to appeal an order denying post-trial relief. This whole mess of deemed denied and do you need notice, all of that's obviously a complicated procedural mess, but the issue on whether we were within 30 or 60 days, both, of notice of entry of the order denying our Rule 50B and our Rule 59 motions for post-trial relief, there's no dispute we were within that time frame.
Wouldn't that open an awful lot of cases where people think that they're closed? I mean, even where someone appeals a judgment on time, they don't bring up their motion for JNOV. Even if they lose the appeal, they can now reopen the appeal and say, well, I've never received notice of the denial of my JNOV, so I can repeal that now. Wouldn't that reopen? I mean, we've dismissed a lot of cases for failure to appeal on time. Now, because you're saying they have to have notice of the denial of a motion for new trial or JNOV, and they never did receive a notice, because the statute doesn't seem to require it, all those things are now reopened in South Dakota.
And the solution is simple. The party that wants the protection should file a notice of entry. Should be the practice of attorneys to do that.
I mean, that seems like that would throw South Dakota law into chaos, though.
I think that was the reason for this. As I recall, this is not a mirror of a federal statute. This is unique to ours for the very reason that you're arguing is that it just leaves everything in limbo. And that I think this was established so that there were some very specific times. And that if you wanted to toll that 20 days, then there should be a motion in there that says that the trial court has more than 20 days to make that decision. If the trial court doesn't make the decision in 20 days, then the time starts ticking again. And I think that was the whole idea under this for the very reason that Justice Konenkamp has indicated. It leaves too many things out there too long.
Again, you know, that would only answer the question as to the judgment itself. But as to the post-trial relief, that would run from notice of entry of the order. There's nothing that says otherwise, and our case law is clear. There's separately appealable issues. In a recent case of Glover versus Cranback held that a post-trial Rule 60B motion is separately appealable from all other issues in the case. It's not new for...
But even Rule 60 motions have term. I mean, there's a standard one-year rule on those with some exceptions. But under your position now on Rule 59, people could appeal a denial of a motion for a new trial 20, 30, 100 years later.
Respectfully, Your Honor, there's actually a more aggressive time frame with motions for a new trial and a motion for JNOV. You have 10 days from notice of entry of the order to file it, not a year. So it's an even more aggressive time frame.
That's assuming that you get someone, the lawyer has to do now the successful party in receiving a judgment and a denial of the motion to reopen, you know, to attack the judgment, has to file two notices now, a notice of entry of judgment, which was done here, and a notice of entry of denial of post-trial relief.
There should be a notice of entry for the order denying post-trial relief, and if there's no action, the court could deem constructive notice by the passage of 20 days when it's a deemed denied issue, but that's not the case here. There was actually an order, and we were within 30 days of notice of entry of that order.
Thank you. Your time is expired. Court will be in recess. Check it.